Resources to order, and we're going to hear House Bill 530, Department of Forestry, a public hearing. Before we start, I'm going to ask, she said I could call her Susie to give us a little update of what we're doing today.
I have other names, but Susie will do. we're going through what the co-chairs have called phase one of the agency review process, and what we'll be doing today is going through an overview of the agency's programs, their mission, what it is that they do. If that might spill over into tomorrow, tomorrow we'll be taking up performance measures and outcomes. And then on Wednesday, what we'll be doing is looking at their priority lists and the reduction lists that they have prepared for the subcommittee. And that'll take up the next 2 days.
Okay, and I would assume in the near future we'll have a permanent chair. There's some shuffling going on for a while here. Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. My name's Marvin Brown, for the record. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry. I'll have different staff joining me as we get into the different program areas here. go ahead and turn that on if you want. We've got before you the PowerPoint presentation that we're going to use. There's some, we'll be showing a few maps and charts here and there, and it might be a little easier to read up on the wall than the ones that you have a hard copy of. Before I start, I'd probably refer you to a couple of other books that you've been given. One of those is what we call the Legislative Briefing Book. This one here, and each member of the committee should have had delivered that. I don't see it on anybody's desk, but it was one that was delivered a couple of weeks ago. And it has a lot of just basic reference material in it. It has the agency's strategic plan, the board's strategic plan, reports on fire and economic development, a variety of things. And then the other one is the one that you've got in front of you, and that's our governor's recommended budget book. This is a work in progress. It has in it the specific things that you all ask us to address for phase one, the 10% reduction, the listing, prioritized listing of services, and the performance measures, and we'll be adding to that the phase two materials when it comes to that. So we've got a slide presentation fixed up to talk about really our programs, our program delivery, and then also the specific recommendations that we were requested to talk about, the performance measures and things. So if we flip to just start right into the presentation, for purposes of kind of planning our staff and showing you what our game plan is, this next slide here, today what we hope we can get through is an overview and a detailed discussion of the fire protection program. After the fire protection program, we'll go right into state forests and private forests, urban community forests, regional programs. Yes, ma'am.
What he's referring to is the slide for overview. There should be a somewhere at your place that the agency placed it there, which is paper copy of what's on the wall. There.
Right, it is. Exact same set of slides. I just wanted to show you roughly the order that we were going to take things in. And I know that those three items you wanted to hone in on, your performance measures, the prioritized list of services, and the 10% reduction, we've actually got built into our presentations and each program some discussion on those items. And it may be that we can answer most of your questions within each program about those things, but if not, we've prepared to talk at the end about those specific items in general, and they are, as I said, detailed information on each of those in your book. So I'll start with the overview. That's page 3 of the hard copy. The overview, we're going to talk about the just generally what the Oregon's forest resource is all about, the Oregon Board of Forestry, how that's structured, what their responsibilities are, what they're working on these days, and then just generally the department as a whole. Next page is talks, gives you some idea of Oregon's forests. Probably not news to anybody here. Out of 62 million acres of total land area in Oregon, 28.5 million acres are forested. And covers both sides of the state, east and west of the Cascades. 46% of the land area total. And the next slide starts to show a little bit of the ownership pattern. It doesn't show up particularly well. The green color that you see there on the wall, as the most common color of green, is all federal land. And the point we'd make is if you go to page 6, 56% of Oregon's forest land is owned by the federal government. And that has a pretty profound influence on everything we do in forestry. 21% is owned by larger industrial interests, 18% by the smaller private non-industrial interests. The state, owns only 3%. Despite the fact we seem to get a lot of attention, we don't really own that much land in the state. And then the 2% other would be primarily counties and local governments. Page 7 gets into some description about the Board of Forestry. They are 7 people, volunteer citizens appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate, confirmed by the Senate. They meet about 7 times a year. The Oregon statute spells out their responsibility as being to supervise all matters of forest policy within Oregon. I answer directly to the Board of Forestry. They are selected. They select the state forester's position. That's whom I report to. And they're also responsible for adopting the forest practices rules and providing general supervision of the department's performance. For a number of years now, they have adopted what they've called the Forestry Program for Oregon, which is essentially the board's strategic planning document. And that one was most recently updated in 2003. As it says here, that's the 5th edition. The first one was 1976. Those have evolved over time. The very first one, the 1976 Forestry Program for Oregon, dealt with how do you sustain timber harvest, essentially. It was about sustained yield of timber harvest in Oregon. And since that time, the topics and what the Forestry Program for Oregon deals with has broadened considerably and really embraces a more complete notion of sustainability that I'll talk about in a little bit. Page 9 shows you how the FPFO, the Forestry Program for Oregon, is structured with the mission, the vision, a set of strategies that are essentially the board's goals for creating sustainable forestry in Oregon. Then value statements define the basic beliefs they have that guide their decisions when it comes to making policy decisions in the state. And then there's a set of priority actions that are outlined there that the Department of Forestry keys off very carefully, and I'll explain that a little bit more, starting with the next page, 10. You can take one example of a strategy that's in the Forestry Program for Oregon, such as Strategy D, which is to protect, maintain, and enhance soil and water resources. Underneath that, there might be a dozen or more Board of Forestry actions, and we've picked one as an example, contribute to statewide efforts under the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And then, as I said, once you get down to that level, then the department's execution starts to kick in, and we use these sets of board decisions to guide the development of our program and the things that we work on. And in this particular place, we've outlined several contributions that the department specifically attaches to the board's strategic plan to guide implementation of our program. Page 11 starts into a little bit of a different direction there. I've only worked for the board for about a year and a half now. I started in June of 2003. And based on some experiences I've had working on other boards and working for other boards and both serving on other boards, I felt like there were some things that I wanted to suggest that would improve how the board went about its business, essentially focus more on policy leadership, really get the board to be the place where all kinds of stakeholders feel like they can come, they can have their views heard and honestly dealt with, and the board would be in a position to react to those issues that are brought up in setting policy and creating leadership. The board was real interested in what those changes might be, so we had a two-day workshop in December and started to construct what we're calling the board's systematic decision systems process, we call it. Kind of an awkward name. But essentially, looking at our responsibilities, the Department of Forestry's responsibility is to effectively support the board in establishing strong leadership and in developing policy and providing oversight to policy. What could we do to help them, and how could they structure their work to be more effective at that? Chair Krieger, I know you were on the board at one time, so maybe this has some resonance with you. I'm not sure. But what we started out with was saying just exactly what is the board's job. And down at the bottom of page 11 there, the three things are most important. The board is there to connect our department to the citizenship of Oregon, to represent their views. They're there to set policy based on the things they learn and they think need dealing with. And they're there to assure that we execute effectively, the department does. Using those as kind of a guide, we started to formulate this system. And by system, we're really using environmental management systems kind of concepts that say you should construct your efforts around the concept of planning what you're going to do, executing what you're going to do, and then evaluating what you did to see what you've learned and how that can improve what you do the next time. That's really the systems kind of process that we're trying to put in place. Part of that is for the board to sit down every year from now on and develop a priority set of objectives that they want to work on, basically to establish their own agenda. And this is a departure from previous boards. Previous boards generally reacted to the department's agenda, and we want boards in the future to create and structure their own agenda based on what they think is important. And when we get this process in place, page 13 there, the department's going to have to be a lot more focused about how and why we provide information to the board. I think that's going to create more efficiency in everybody's time. We're going to see more opportunities for the board to interact in an unfiltered way with stakeholders. To create a good use of time there, we're trying to build that around specific issues. And in order for the board to really implement the concept of planning and doing and checking, they're going to spend more time telling us how they want to monitor and interact with the decisions that they've made so that we can create that connection between what they've decided and what actually gets done. When they began to set their objectives this year, they identified seven important issues that they felt like they wanted to work on. And these really are a step down from the Forestry Program for Oregon. It begins to say, what exactly is the board going to do to implement the Forestry Program for Oregon? And they picked these seven areas to work on. Maintaining the viability of Oregon's forests, applying adaptive management to state forest plans, such as the Tillamook and the Clatsop, better connecting natural resource interests to the state's urban population, formulating forest policy around the concept of dynamic ecosystems, and on page 15, overseeing what you'll hear more about today, which is a comprehensive broad-based fire program review, continuing to evaluate and make better decisions and improvements and refinements in our regulatory system that we administer, and then just using the Forestry Program for Oregon as a good policy leadership tool. So that's kind of where the board's thinking is these days on things that they think are important to work on. In the end, page 16 there, this is what we would like to see created, a board environment that focuses on leadership and is viewed as a place to deal with the state's most important forest issues in an open and productive manner. If we can get to that point, I think everybody will be better served. Page 17 is a basic concept that you'll find throughout the forestry program for Oregon and built throughout our strategic plan. And it deals with how you define forest sustainability. The definition of forest sustainability that is employed throughout all of our thinking and philosophy is that for a forest to be sustainable, it's got to consider economic benefits, it's got to consider environmental benefits, and it has to consider social benefits. It has to do all of these. And, you know, an important concept that we're trying to really message to people these days, because I think it's something that's going to has the potential, put it that way, bringing us past conflict and getting us more towards productive decision making. That piece is that when you talk about economic interest and environmental interest and social interest, you're not talking about competing political interests. You know, you're not talking about constantly negotiating to see who gets what piece of the pie of those three interests. What we're talking about is that all three of those things are absolutely dependent on one another. And I think that's very important. And I think that's an expectation we have of engaging in dialogue with anybody who wants to talk about sustainable forestry. That in order to provide environmental and social benefits, a forest has to have economic value. It has to generate the dollars to provide for environmental programs, to create recreational programs and things like that. If you don't protect the environmental benefits like soil and water, you're going to erode the economic value of the forest. So you can't escape the economic responsibilities. And if you don't deal with the social interests, you know, what people feel, think, care about the forest, then people aren't going to allow you to manage for any reason. So those are all interdependent values that have to be dealt with that way, not as competing interests in our mind. I think that's something you'll see built in all of our communications. From there, you know, the lofty point, I just quickly get into a little bit about the Department of Forestry. Our last biennium budget was $226 million. We have approximately 700 permanent full-time staff, and we have approximately 700 permanent seasonal staff, primarily for firefighting, but also other programs. 15%, page 19, 15% of our budget comes from the general fund, 8% comes from federal funds, and 77% from other funds. And some of the most prominent are listed there. They are the landowner assessments for the fire protection program, the revenues from state forest timber sales, the timber harvest tax, and then also grants and direct reimbursements that we receive for services. Page 20 lists our programs. On the left-hand side are our primary resource programs: protection from fire, state forests, private forests, urban and community forestry. That's on the left side. On the right side, then it just lists our kind of general administrative and support type activities. And you can see from that pie chart that 44% of our total effort goes into the fire program. The next largest program is state forests. The next largest is private forest management, and then urban forestry is just kind of a sliver at this point. The next page is our organizational chart. There's been two changes in this structure since the last biennium. The last time that we were here, there was a deputy state forester position who supervised the three area directors that you see on the right-hand side. When the deputy, Roy Wu, retired, we eliminated that position, and the three area directors now report directly to me. The only other change is that in order to have a clearly designated second-in-command when I'm not available, Clark Seeley was elevated from assistant state forester to associate state forester. He still maintains his administrative responsibilities, all basically the things he's done in the past, but he's also the person that's there to act on my behalf if I'm not available. So we've essentially reduced our executive staff by one person during the last biennium. We are page 22, our strategic plan really plays off of the forestry program for Oregon, and it is something that we use to plan our budget requests and execute our program overall. You can see the things that are implement are a part of the strategic plan, but I think I would just refer you right on to page 23, which is a flowchart about how the strategic plan is developed. Up at the top left-hand side there, you see forest assessments and the first approximation report. Those are just the basic information that tells us how the resource is doing in Oregon, what kind of conditions and what are the issues that we need to deal with. From that feeds the board's development of the forestry program for Oregon. It's planned for about an 8-year period. We use the forestry program for Oregon to develop our agency strategic plan. From that, then we construct our biennial implementation plans that are the basis for our budget request. Every year, then, we break those biennial plans down into what we've accomplished and, you know, what works and doesn't work within our strategic plan. You see that up at the top of the right-hand column. And we use that information to ultimately feed back into those other levels of planning again. And kind of, the plan do check systematic way to continually improve, hopefully.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. I was just checking, you know, 55 or 56% of the land is federal land. How much interaction did your agency have with the federal government?
We, Chair Krieger and Senator Nelson, there's a couple of different levels of interaction there. At the ground level, the most interaction we have is in the fire program, and we have a very coordinated protection system in the state that includes federal and state resources, and we'll talk about that in more detail when we talk about the fire program, but there is a very high level of interaction at that level. When it comes to how they plan and allocate their resources and establish their objectives for managing federal lands, it's much less at this point.
They're not a part of the strategic planning. You're pretty much separate in this area.
Chair Krieger, Senator Nelson, no, they're not that much at this point. But what I would say is that the Board of Forestry has decided that within one of their issue areas that they call forest viability, they have decided that they need to be a lot more expressive about federal land issues, because federal land issues are so completely intermixed with, you know, the sustainability of Oregon's forests, you know, protecting the infrastructure on the, you know, particularly the eastern side of the state, where federal lands actually make up 72% of the federal of the forest on the eastern side of the state. But the board has decided they would like to be a lot more expressive about what federal direction should be in the state. And we really haven't, you know, formulated exactly what that's going to look like at this point. But the governor in October addressed the Board of Forestry and gave them the charge of what he called create a unified vision of federal land management on behalf of Oregon's citizens. And it's kind of our thinking that if the board can become this leadership-oriented, stakeholder kind of a place where people can come and express their views and be heard, and the board can use that to formulate positions that do reflect a broad set of interests in Oregon, that we've got a pretty powerful message there to work with our, you know, our federal delegation then. And I think it would be a good use of the board's time. But it's, as you probably know, it's hard to move federal policy. But
just one further follow-up. I've heard the statement made, and I guess maybe I've made it too a couple times, is that the decline that we've had in our public services, while masked by the technology boom in the 1990s, has pretty much paralleled the decline in our forest industry. Do you have any sense of that?
Chair Krieger and Senator Nelson, I'm not sure about what you mean by the services, but the forest industry has declined dramatically in Oregon in the last 12 to 13 years. And the grossest figure there is going from an annual harvest level of about 8 billion feet to below 4 billion feet, I think, at a low point of 2002. And it's
4 billion
feet for the state as a total, from 8 billion.
How much of that was federal? How much was...
Almost all of that reduction was on federal lands and more. Because at the same time that federal lands were being harvested less, private lands were producing more, to the point where there's been an over-harvest of private lands east of the Cascades.
Thank you, Chair. I have actually five questions written down. The first one is one you asked. Thank you.
I must have been looking at
it. Well, the reason I'm asking is this is a little bit of forestry 101 for me, so I don't want to take a lot of time up for people that know the answers of stupid questions I might ask, but so I'll go ahead and ask some stupid questions anyway. I come from an area that's resource based to a great degree. Well, the rest of the state has moved into high tech. We've stayed to a great degree in a natural resources area. And I agree with Senator Nelson. The state is dependent primarily on income tax for its DHS budget, which I'm very involved with. And with the decline of natural resources and the decline of revenue from good family wage jobs, it's affected the rest of the state more than a lot of people realize. Having said all that, that's from the background I come from. And my real questions are, we have a mixture of federal state land, the BLM, Forest Service, private lands, and a small percentage of state lands, if I remember right, very small, 2 or 3% or something of that nature. Who really has authority over how much of a cut occurs, the bottom line is? Is it primarily a federal decision made at the federal level with some input from the Forestry Board and from our federal delegation? Or do you have pretty broad authority in making those decisions? The sense we're getting in Southern Oregon is we are pretty well locked out of the natural forest right now, and it's really affected our local economy because of that. There was questions of overcutting at one point. Those questions seem to be off the table, but the land still seemed to be locked up. I'd like to hear your position on that if you feel comfortable in stating it publicly.
Sure, Senator Tarrant Krieger and Senator Bates, first, there's no stupid questions, period.
There may be some for me before you're through.
No, not at all. The question you just asked is one that if we had an easy answer to, that we'd all be better off. But in terms of control, the state does not have any control over federal harvesting policy at this point. We get chances to express an opinion, and that's about it, really. The landowners are the ones who determine the rate at which they harvest their land, and the only thing that controls that rate on private lands, you know, for example, the small non-industrial landowners or the big industrial landowners, the only thing that controls that rate is that forest regulations do limit the size of a clear cut, and they do indicate that before you can harvest next to an existing clear cut, that stand has to grow for 2 or 3 years. So that's really the only thing that limits the rate at which private lands are harvested. Federal lands, we don't have any say, really. And that's, as I was answering Senator Nelson's question, the board really would like to change that, would really like to find ways to interject the state point of view and really do that in a way that brings a broad perspective, brings a clear voice for Oregon, and gives our federal delegation, you know, more ammunition, if you would, more reason to say these are the things that are important to Oregonians and these are the people who are talking about it. But it's not any kind of statutory ability at all.
No, I'll have a question for LFO later. I'd like to have you break down the revenue streams better. You have other funds for 200 some odd million and no breakdown of the other funds. Since it's the biggest part of the budget, I'd like to see the breakdown of it.
Okay.
Just kind of a clear question. Just in the back of my mind, it seems to me that the cut from the private timber owners or anything other than federal is right around 3 billion board feet a year, and that's been pretty steady over this period of time. Would that be a fair statement?
Chair Krieger and Senator Nelson, no. The figures would be something, and I'm not going to get these exactly right. But in 2003, the harvest across the entire state of Oregon was a little over 4 billion feet, about 4.2. Federal land was about...
That's in our book.
It probably is. These don't have real good numbers, but I'm thinking federal land is in the neighborhood of 350 million feet.
It's up this year, about 200 and some odd million over the last several years.
Right. So out of 4.2 billion, that however many acres, 16 million acres of federal land produced less timber than our 750,000 acres of state land, state-owned land. We produced about 330 million feet total, I think, something like that. They produced less than 300 million feet.
Marvin, wasn't the original Clinton plant in Northwest Forest supposed to be a billion a year?
Yes.
So they have fallen way short all those years.
Representative Chair Krieger, yes. It should have, the Northwest Forest Plan did call for something along those lines, and it hasn't come close.
Just a couple of things I want to bring up. When we get to the fire program, I want to make sure we cover the relationship we're having with the federal government when they allow the things to burn to a certain, you know, I know there's some conversation about when we're going to step in with this federal land or not. Also, you mentioned the forestry program from Oregon, which I'm very familiar with. I'd like to have a breakdown of staff time and cost of updating and maintaining that. And I realize how it might apply on state forest land, the HCP, and the plans we've done on the state lands, you know, the Elliott, the Clatsop, Tillamook. But I have a little bit more of a problem is how you apply those values and things onto private land. You can do it maybe through an incentive program, but discuss kind of the relationship for the FPO and the private lands issue as far as ownership and property rights.
Chair Krieger, we'll be happy to do those things, and those should fit within our program discussions pretty well.
Senator Shields, do you have any?
No.
Okay, go ahead. You got another one?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I asked the chair here if I could ask a few more questions, and if I'm being redundant, let me know. Over the weekend, and I didn't bring it back with me, I was looking at some figures on the harvest levels we've done in the last several years, and they seemed like those levels were below what was allowed consistently, but I couldn't see a breakdown in the chart that I had of if it was federal land, private land, state land, or a combination of all three. What I'd like to see is, if you can, give me a better idea what that breakdown is and why we haven't harvested to our full ability to. Is there not a market for it? Is there courts stopping us from doing it? And give me a feel for what's happening, why we haven't reached our levels. I'd also like to get a feel for what the historical harvest has been with the dramatic reduction we've seen recently in federal lands. Is that based on good science? Is it based on court decisions? What's driving that substantial change? Are we over-harvesting our private lands, which you mentioned you think you're concerned with? Are we under-harvesting our federal lands, and are we blocked from increasing that harvest? That's things you read about in the papers, you can't seem to get a good handle on. Hopefully you guys have the science that can bring it to us and give us some feeling for it and what things are happening. If we do need, if we do have an ability to harvest more, bring to us those things need to be changed that we can affect at this level.
Chair Krieger and Senator Bates, yeah, we'll be happy to provide you just about all that information is available, and we can pull it out and provide it to you. One specific answer is really we don't have any control over the federal land harvest level at this point. I would like that the board, like I said, the board's process to really create this vision of what federal land should contribute in Oregon would be something that everybody supported and embraced and really created a powerful message for the federal government and for our federal delegation, for our senators and congressmen in Washington, D.C. I think that's one way to start to change it, is to really create a strong vision of what needs to happen on federal lands in Oregon. But in terms of, there really is no state law that can be written that would change the level of harvest on federal lands at this point.
Senator Shields?
Yes, I do appreciate Dr. Bates suggesting the questions he suggested. Senator, I guess he's been taken to another question here. I wanted to ask you to recognize the parameters that they have to work within, in the sense that, I mean, I've been hauled around these forests enough to know that there was a 1 to 12, a 1 to 3, and a 1 to 1 ratio operating. The 1 to 12 is for every foot that we cut in federal forests, there's 12 feet growing. In a state forest, for every board foot we're growing, there's every foot we cut, there's 3 feet growing, and 1 to 1 is sustainable. And that's what's happening in the private forests. These guys don't have much control over that, the bigger picture, but as we get out in those state forests, I think we're doing a very good job. The thing that you did surprise me with was that you said, and I assume 1-to-1 is happening on this side of the mountains. Are you suggesting that it's not 1-to-1 east of the mountains on private land?
Ms. Chair Krieger and Senator Shields, yeah, our information, you know, that we track through the harvest tax and other means, it seems pretty clear that not every acre, but a number of instances on the east of the mountains, that the land is being overharvested. It's being harvested quicker than it's growing.
I suppose the relevant piece there, follow-up, would be that we probably have a lot more private forest land on this side than the other side of the mountains, or am I wrong in that?
Chair Krieger, Senator Shields, no, you're right. On the east of the mountains, about 72% of the forest land is owned by the federal government. So we have private is a much smaller percentage over there than it is on the west of the mountains.
That could be less.
Yeah, there's a difference on what the science is that drives things at the federal level, and what people that come to see you and testify before the board. There's a document, I guess Dr. Paul Adams, Science 101, something I remember that Jim Brown gave us one time. It would be a good idea if you got that, a copy, if you could, for us, and give it to the members, because from it you're able, there's some criteria there to look at, the testimony that you get from scientists as to evaluate whether it's their personal opinion, has it been peer-reviewed, is it something you can rely on, or you got to take it with a grain of salt. So if you read that, I think it will help you in all your deliberations and every committee you're in, because the same thesis or idea or basis behind judging that, I think, applies everywhere. I read it once a month.
Appreciate that, Chair. Well,
try to dig that up.
Okay. Just page 24 is one of the specific requests that were made that we bring to this specific portion of the budget review. That's our prioritized agency services. Those are specific services. They're not agency programs. They're services within different programs. And it just says from 1 to 11, 1 being our highest priority is the forest fire protection that we provide at the local level, and priorities proceed down from there. That's how we try to base our, you know, scarce resource allocation decision making. If anybody has any questions on what any of those mean, I'd be happy to answer it, or I'll move on to, we're about to get into specific programs. Okay. Page 25, this is really the outline that we want to present to you for each of our programs. What we want to do in each area, fire, state forest, private forest, is talk about first the value that we create, really why do we exist, what is it that that makes it important that we do our job. And we'll blend into that a discussion of outcomes and performance measures that we use to establish whether or not we're getting the job done. It'll give you a little bit of history and context on these programs, where they came from and how they operate. And then there's a line down there that says, what issues affect cost and value delivery? This is probably a little bit different than what some of the previous budget discussions have revolved around. But what I find useful when I try to manage these programs is to isolate the things that affect cost and the things that affect our ability to deliver value, just exactly what are the barriers and the issues that make it more costly for us to do something or make it more difficult for us to do something. We can isolate those and then start working on them, then I think that's how we improve management. So we're going to, in each program area, provide our view of what issues affect cost and value delivery, and we'll describe for you some of the actions and steps that were taken to isolate and work on those issues. And then again, based on the request that we have for specific information, we'll look a little bit at the effect of the LFO 10% budget for each program. And if there's no questions there, I'm going to ask our fire division chief, Tim Keith, to come up and start you to look at our fire protection program.
Okay. For the record, Chair Cree, members of the committee, my name is Tim Keith. I'm an assistant state forester in charge of the protection division, and it's my pleasure to be able to describe our protection from fire program here today. Next. Statewide, we protect 15.7 million acres of forest land. That includes all of the industrial and non-industrial and family farm forest land statewide, as well as city, county, and state forest land, and Western Oregon BLM forest land. That land has $60-plus billion in values at risk, a tremendous asset to the state.
Keith, is that the forest value or other things on that private land?
Chair Krieger, that's the forest value as well as improvements and recreational values, that sort of thing. It's an estimate of the total value of that forest land beyond just the forest resource. Acreage burned from 1960 to 2004 is presented here. In the first 40 years of the agency since 1911, we did have 18 seasons where we experienced 100,000 acre fire seasons or greater. Since 1951, we've actually had no seasons in which we've experienced 100,000 acres lost, although certainly in 1987 and 2002 we approached that mark. Our 10-year average for acres burned is 24,000 acres.
This is just the state number, state forest number.
Chair Krieger, Senator Shields, that's correct. That's on state protected forest.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
It would be interesting just for comparison to see what the federal number looks like, you know, in relative numbers.
I believe they can get you that, and they can also show you the average size of fires on federal land because they don't have a quick response as we do.
Right.
Pretty astounding.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see that.
Chair Krieger, Senator Shields, we can provide you that. It sometimes comes across as bragging or free for our program, but we will provide you that. As far as the number of fires over the last 44 years, our 20-year average is 1,150 fires, and if you look at that pattern over that time and consider the fact that we've had tremendous population growth into the wild and urban interface, we believe we're pretty successful with our prevention program statewide also. The next slide describes the two key performance measures that we have been measuring for a considerable period of time. The first performance measure there is the number of or percent of fires that we control at 10 acres or less. The benchmark is 94%, And as you can see, with the exception of 2002, we've met that performance measure. And in 2004, I'm happy to report that that number was 97.6%. So again, we exceeded that.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question. Going back to 27, a little bit behind you, but I was just saying you're protecting $15.7 million. That doesn't come up to the figures that I had that you gave on one of those earlier slides. And,
on acres of protected ground?
Yeah, I mean, we have a total of, there's 28.5 million acres of forest land, so you're saying, I'll see. And I think the federal government owns 56%. Seems to me this figure actually represents the federal.
Chair Krieger, Senator Nelson, we protect also on the west side approximately 2.3 million acres of BLM land.
So you do protect some
so
of
that, BLM. Yes. So we do have so some federal protection.
I was just checking those figures.
That's a contract.
That's a contract. Yes, sir. We'll talk about that.
I just saw there was a little difference.
The second performance measure there, it's actually... below that line is a good thing. That's the number of man-caused or human-caused fires per capita, and our performance measure is 27.2 fires per 100,000 residents in the state of Oregon. And with the exceptions of 1995 and 96 fire seasons, we've been below that performance measure line. We're pretty proud of that number also. For 2004, the number is actually 18.5 fires per 100,000 residents in the state. Program history and a little background, and actually I'll start earlier in the century than 1911. There were some events leading up to 1911 that really changed the course of where we are today. In 1902, over 700,000 acres burned on the west side of Oregon, including the Yauco fire, extremely destructive. From that, an effort began where landowners came together in fire patrol associations, and in fact, Linn County was the first fire patrol association to come together in the western United States in 1904. Then in 1910, over 1 million acres burned in the nation, some tremendous Great Basin fires, hundreds of thousands of acres burned in Montana, and that led to the passage of the Federal Weeks Law, which provided funding for states to protect forest land. And that, with that funding base, then in 1911, the Oregon legislature created the first set of Oregon fire laws, the Board of Forestry, as well as then the state forester. But then in 1913, the state took a huge leap forward, the first of its kind in the nation, and passed a compulsory fire patrol law, which mandated a forest protection system in the state, and it established the landowner's responsibility to either provide that protection or pay the state to provide the protection. And that essentially is the system that we have today in the forest protection system. The Forest Protective Associations were formed as a result of the early Fire Patrol Associations. In a number of cases, they provided that protection. In a number of other cases, the state districts were formed and provided that protection. A number of the operating associations have survived to this day. Coos Forest Protective Association, Douglas Forest Protective Association, and Walker Range in Central Oregon. And they're vibrant, healthy systems, and they're a very important part of the forest fire protection system in the state. This map, and you also have a copy of the map up there, basically that map depicts the district boundaries in the state where our statutory authority is present. All the national forest lands are also contained within those district boundaries. Our statutory authority does not apply outside of the boundaries that are established on the map. Next. statewide. We have 13 protection districts, three of which are operating associations, as we mentioned. Those three provide the prevention preparedness, including detection and readiness, as well as suppression, the initial attack, extended attack, and large fire suppression. Statewide, we manage what we call a complete and coordinated system, where basically we work with a number of partners in order to do the best job possible. And first and foremost, the forest landowners and forest operators are really the rock, if you will, of the system and the partnership with those folks. We have Salem Mobilization Center that's linked to the Federal Northwest Coordination Center in Portland, which is in turn linked to the National Interagency Coordination Center in Boise. So we do have those linkages to work with the federal agency partners. We have agreements statewide with the U.S. Forest Service and Department of Interior agencies for fire protection and joint fire suppression. We have very good cooperation with the rural fire departments and the Office of State Fire Marshal here in the state. That's a really important part of the system, particularly in the rural, wild and urban interface. We have contracts with private resources. Our agency administers the crew contract, and Forest Service, the engine and tender contract, and I'll talk about that briefly later. We're a member of the Northwest Compact, which consists of the western states and Canadian provinces. When things turn really bad, such as 2002, we're able to invoke the compact and bring resources to the state. Washington, Idaho, Montana, folks from other states have come to our aid. And then in return, when we can, we provide aid to others. Last summer, we sent resources to Alaska, British Columbia, as well as the state of Washington.
Senator Bates?
I'd like to ask a question, if I could. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Concerning the funding for the fire suppression and firefighting, I was out of the room for a few minutes. Did you deal with that before I came in, or I was out?
Chair Krieger, Senator Bates, I'll be talking in some detail later about that, if you'd permit me to delay the answer.
Sorry to jump ahead on you. I'm sorry.
Thank you. As far as our statewide program budget and positions, in the 2003-2005 legislatively approved budget, the fire program is approximately $100 million, of which 370 permanent full-time equivalent positions are there, as well as approximately 500 seasonal positions. And in the governor's recommended budget, it recommends approximately $104 million in 393 full-time equivalents.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you provide for us a breakdown on all of your vacant positions? If you could, please, at perhaps tomorrow.
Chair Krieger, Representative Crow, we will do that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now talk a little bit about Oregon Department of Forestry resources, and I need to make the disclaimer here that this also includes those operating association resources. We have 230 engines and water tenders statewide, 13 dozers that are part of the initial attack program, 32 lookouts for detecting fires. We have a number of other program militia trained as overhead, our stewardship foresters, state lands foresters, administrative personnel, and Salem staff personnel. Virtually everyone in our organization is available for militia, if you will, to be called out to combat the large fires. We have three incident management teams and three fire cache support systems to manage those large fires that do occur. I think if I would apply an overall theme here, that it's the goal of the department for early detection of fires, rapid and aggressive initial attack to keep them small. That keeps the damage down and it keeps the cost down. Cooperator resources, and I mentioned it early, but I can't say enough about it, and that's the landowners and operators are really the bedrock of the program. They provide overhead engines, water tenders, dozers, and helicopters. There has been a shift away from the 60s and 70s when we heavily used mill crews and woods crews and that void has been filled by contract crews. We work with and help train 24 Department of Corrections 10-person inmate crews, and they also provide the kitchen support for our fire cache kitchens. As part of the interagency contract that we administer, there are 234 crews, 20-person crews, available for firefighting. There's the Oregon State Fire Marshal fire teams, incident management teams, and structural task forces. Basically, if there is a large fire, we divide the job up. We manage and put the wildland fire out, if you will, and they protect the structures. So it's a paired responsibility.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When it's appropriate, could you also share with us any changes that you may be making in contract crew requirements in terms of their ability to respond? I'm aware of some contract crews that in fact are not being truthful in terms of where they're based out of, and so that when you call them, sometimes they don't respond within the time frame they are supposed to. And at some point, I'd like to have someone from your agency address where you might be going with trying to remedy that problem.
Chair Krieger, Representative Krupp, good question. We've just in this last biennium, and basically we're successful in ramping up, if you will, our contract services management section. We now have 4 full-time employees in that section. It's funded from fees from the crew days of those that use the crews. And prior to that time, there were indeed those problems. There will certainly continue to be some, but our contract inspection has revealed a number of falsified addresses, and we've terminated those contracts. The word spread, if you will, throughout the industry, and other contractors actually withdrew their contract crew availability from certain locations. And I think what we're left with here the core of the contract crew business. We started the year with 299 crews that initially submitted bids, and this is what we ended up with. So there was a fair amount of attrition, if you will, and there may continue to be. We're continuing to look at records and pursue aggressively the administration of the contract crew system.
Very good, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say that I think you've done an outstanding job at trying to clean up that particular, they say in the law business, I'm not a lawyer, but never ask a question unless you know the answer. You've done a great job with that, and I think you guys do a great job of responding quickly, and that's one of those key elements to that. So attaboys to you.
One other point. The urban interface problem that we've had as Oregon grows and moves out, can you talk at some point, maybe not right now, regarding small rural fire departments and training that's available, any training program that was available for them?
Chair Krieger, I can talk some to that. Essentially, most of the training for those folks comes from the Oregon State Fire Marshal and DPSST. Struggling with
what it means.
what it means, which is provides the training and certification for firefighters. But we have an active role in training some of the smaller rural fire departments, the newly formed rangeland districts in the east side, and we also administer 2 pass-through grant programs and also provide them quite a bit of federal excess property to help staff their provide equipment for their programs.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson.
Just a clarification on page 34, you're talking about 393 FTEs. That's on the governor's recommended budget. But back on page 18, you're talking about 700 permanent positions. I'm presuming the difference is the federal funding. What is the difference there?
Chair Krieger and Senator Nelson, the 700 full-time permanent FTEs and 700 seasonal FTEs cover all of our department programs. That would be people who manage state forests, people who administer the State Forest Practices Act, people who run the nursery. And what Tim is talking about here specifically are the FTEs that are allocated to the Fire Protection Services.
Okay, thank you very much.
With your permission, Chair Krieger, I'll continue.
We're going to let you go here in a minute.
That third from the last bullet there, the Oregon National Guard, particularly in the heavy helicopter business, when the helicopter industry, their resources have been stripped because of fire danger, we are able to bring their heavy helicopter fleet to bear. And when times have been really tough, also train National Guard firefighters for duty. But obviously with the current situation overseas, those resources probably are not available to us for a while. Federal agencies, from with our cooperators in the federal agencies, there are overhead. They do assist us in our large fire management. They have their own complement of engines and water tenders. Air tankers, and we'll talk a little bit about that later because that's certainly not the resource it used to be. Helicopters, incident management teams, and then national and international coordination. And then finally, a really important resource, and one I think Susie can appreciate, is FEMA funding. The rules have changed some over recent years, and some of my staff have excellent relationships with the FEMA folks, and we've been very successful in getting FEMA declarations on a number of fires, which brings to bear up to 75% reimbursement for some of the costs of fighting large fires, and that's an important resource.
Thank you. Now, I don't know the answer to this question, but I just wonder, I recall when we were going through the work group that we had put together for some time in this last interim regarding insurance and those things, that we had quite a backlog in receivables from the federal government in terms of these funds. Where are we at on that right now?
Chair Krieger, representing Krupp, the backlog as far as payments from the 2002 season, they've met that, as well as we've received our insurance payments from that season. So we're caught up, if you will, as far as the finances of the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. And I'll talk some more about the fund
great
later.
Thank you.
We, as was mentioned earlier, protect Western Oregon BLM land, which is the intermingled Oregon and California Railroad lands, as well as some public domain lands in Western Oregon. With the intermingled nature of those, oftentimes it's just a checkerboarded pattern. It makes sense to have one agency do the job, and so we've taken that on. Historically, it was an agreement dating back to 1953, and in recent years it's migrated to a contract. That contract sets standards for the services and deliverables. Basically, though, BLM is treated like any other landowner. They're a member of the local budget committees and have standing there. But there is mechanism for additional protection, and in some cases they choose to exercise that mechanism, paying extra for services such as additional patrol, helicopters, that sort of thing. So, but if they choose to have an extra level of protection, they pay for it. It's just an excellent long-standing relationship with the Bureau. Talk a little bit about the level of protection in funding. Essentially, it's our goal to provide an adequate level of protection through studies and modeling. We attempt to determine the most efficient level of protection and then strive for that in the local budgets. Our local budgets are closely scrutinized by non-operating forest protective associations, which have come through the years to today and are advisory to the districts. they review the level of protection, review the budgets annually, and essentially approve both the level of protection as well as then that budget. They approve not only the local district budget, but also our area and Salem headquarters services budgets. So there's actually a statewide group of landowners that come in and look at those services and ensure that they're in line with what they expect as far as service to the local districts. So there's quite a bit of accountability there. The way I look at it, that gives us that direct connection to the forest landowner, who basically is the customer. And I think that's really the strength of our program. Once those budgets are approved by the local budget committee, then the Board of Forestry reviews and approves the district budgets and sets the assessment rates. And those rates are then assessed to the landowners on a per acre basis through their property taxes. It's usually labeled fire patrol if you've ever seen one of those. The next bullet, actual cost allocation. And I think the point we wanted to make there is that the districts are accountable for that expenditures. And if they incur additional costs, debits, as well as savings, credits, then those debits or credits are carried forward to the next year, which either drive up or down the rate they pay per acre. So cost accountability is extremely important, as well as performance accountability. The Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund kicks in when fires escape initial attack. There's a need for additional resources, retardant, industry dozers, contract crew resources, you know, pretty tremendous costs. The Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which is solely funded by the landowners in the state, then kicks in and reimburses the districts for the costs that they incur there. Over the years, the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund has purchased insurance for catastrophic fires. We have a catastrophic fire policy in place for this year, up until April 1st of this year. And then finally, the cost collection from responsible parties. We have a very aggressive and systematic system of cost collection for parties that start a fire in which they're negligent in the cause of that fire. We issue demand letters, and after the third demand letter, if they haven't responded and paid the bill, if you will, then the cost collection is turned over to the Attorney General's office for pursuit.
Thank you. Just briefly, I want to go back to something you said, Tim, about the insurance for catastrophic fires. Is we have a policy in effect until April 1st. Is that when the policy expires and we have to renew?
Chair Krieger, Representative Krupp, that's exactly correct. And at this point in time, the ability to purchase insurance sunsets after this policy period. So, you know, we'll talk about House Bill 2327 a little later, but that bill will come in front of your folks for deliberation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is the infamous Plasky that's been around a while, and hopefully this will answer some of the questions you have, Senator Bates. There it is. I'll sit back a little bit. These first two boxes, essentially, you've got a $28.4 million annually in our protection budgets that include initial attack, resource readiness, prevention, detection, area and Salem fire management, as well as the initial attack system. That coupled with the district deductibles for eligibility for emergency fire cost reimbursement, which is a maximum of $3.2 million, these first two boxes are the responsibility equally of the landowner as well as the general public. It's 50% landowner costs, 50% general fund. The exception to that are the public landowners, which pay 100% of the cost.
Just Just to make sure I'm clear on this, you've got kind of mixed expenditures with funding sources here, so I want to make sure I've got this straight. So the first 30 some odd million is 50% general fund and 50% the taxes you've talked about per acre on private lands that we're talking about.
Chair Krieger, Senator Bates, that's correct.
And that looks like that includes some of the deductible against a different policy, right?
Chair Krieger, Senator Bates, that includes a deductible against becoming eligible for those costs to be reimbursed from the emergency fire costs account, either from insurance or from the fund itself.
Sorry to interrupt. I just want to be sure I understood. Okay, go ahead.
For this, we're talking about this current fiscal year that we're in that ends June 30th. Then we have the next tier, which is $15 million deductible, the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, which is provides the oversight for the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. Landowners are responsible for this entire $15 million. It comes from another number of sources, but it's 100% landowner money. That $15 million policy, as well as bought with a $3.9 million insurance premium, bought us $25 million of insurance. So if we were to have spent the $15 million deductible, then the insurance would have kicked in. It would appear that that won't be the case for this year. And then once we go past, basically it would be $40 million of emergency fire cost expenditures, then the public or the general fund is responsible for costs over $40 million. That in a nutshell, is the funding system of the fire protection program. It's pretty complicated, but that's a system that works well.
Yeah, I think I do understand it, I hope. And kind of mixed apples and oranges on me the way I'm looking at. I look at a lot of budgets for the state, and so this one's a little different for me. I want to make sure I follow you correctly. The $15 million landowners are responsible for here in the middle, that includes the money it's used for buying the premium for the FCC insurance policy. Is that correct?
Chair Krieger, Senator Bates, that's correct. There's a $15 million ceiling on their expenditures. So if they were to have had a tough season and had spent the entire deductible, then according to the law, that they could not buy insurance.
And the deductible is against that $25 million. They have to get the deductible before the $25 million kicks in, obviously.
That's correct.
So what's the total amount of revenue available for fighting forest fire, excluding the last general fund monies? You've got $25 million and $28 million, $28.4 million. Is that correct?
Chair Krieger, Senator Bates, you've got the $28.4 million, of which the district deductibles are actually rolled up in that amount. So that's a little bit deceiving. Then you have $40 million in the policy, as well as the insurance. So once you've gone past essentially $68 million in any given year, but $40 million of emergency expenditures, then the general fund's responsible. Portions of the state could easily have an easy season and not spend all of their district budget. So that's certainly their desire to do that and keep costs down. So we may not spend the entire $28.4 million in any given fiscal year with our regular budgets.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Bates,
I seem to remember that initially, a couple of sessions ago, we had an insurance policy from Lloyd's of London that was bigger than $25 million. Is my memory correct? It was more in the neighborhood of $50 million.
Chair Krieger, Senator Bates, I've got some folks in the audience that know that better than I. We have had larger policies, that's correct.
It was
Chair Krieger, Charlie Stone with the Department of Forestry. You're absolutely right, Senator Bates, that prior to the 2001-2002 fire season, when we accepted the insurance for pretty healthy claims, for I think about 6 years or so prior to that, we had $43 million in coverage above a $10 million deductible, so a total of $53 million in coverage. In 2000, trying to buy the policy for 2003, The carriers insisted on increasing the deductible to $15 million, at the same time lower the amount of coverage available to us and increase the premium cost. So we took quite a hit there, and we're slowly climbing back.
Follow, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to belabor the point, but I'm trying to get to. I also serve on the e-board, and we did some sweating this summer. Okay, we had a very low ending balance, and we had two major storm fronts come through the state, and thank God they both dumped rain. If they hadn't done that, we might have been in trouble covering these costs. And so my overall concern is that we not leave ourselves exposed in a situation with the drought we're having right now in the northern part of the state this summer. We have a repeat of this last summer, but without the rain, and we don't have the general fund to back this thing up. So I'd like to get somewhere down the line a general feeling about what the exposure to the state general fund would be in a major fire season such as we had in, I think it was 2001, where we went to a lot of resources fighting those fires, and sort of give us a worst-case scenario of a really bad fire season this summer, which we're working towards here, and what the state would be on the hook for above what your insurance policy and what the landowners are putting into it. Because if you give me that kind of a picture at a later time, I'd appreciate it.
If I could, Chair Krieger, just a little bit on that. This committee is going to have the opportunity to explore that whole question in considerable depth. We've got a bill that's moved from the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee to this committee. It's House Bill
2327.
And what it does is try to provide some policy guidance on the split between landowner support and general fund support in the fire program. It also provides some needed authority to, again, purchase insurance. One of the issues in that bill right now is that if we don't get the authority to purchase insurance, then we have none for the coming season, and the general fund is badly exposed for any costs. So that, I guess just an editorial note, I hope that we can move on that fairly quickly because we need to be shopping for our policy in March sometime, and that's why it moved out of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee as quickly as it did.
Yeah, you know, we got lucky last summer.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, most of those fronts that came through had a lot of rain, and we were lucky.
Okay, continue.
Our total district budget trend in 2001 dollars is depicted here. It's been relatively stable since the 1997 fiscal year when there were some fundamental changes made to what was included in the district budgets. Now, the key principles of our Protection from Fire program is it is a business service. Landowners, in particular BLM, have options. They could do it themselves. It focuses on local input and involvement as well as local accountability and control. And I would add that accountability and control is for both the performance of the system as well as cost accountability. Severity resources. Districts are budgeted for that average worst season, but the reality is no one can afford to budget for the worst case scenarios that do occur occasionally, particularly the multiple start dry lightning storms. But if we're with careful analysis and some of our developing fire intelligence tools, we can predict a lot of those severe days and plan ahead. And if we can bring additional resources to bear on the situation, we can reduce large fire occurrence. And what I mean by additional resources would be aviation resources, pre-staged engines and hand crews and dozers. But before the rain started this last summer in mid-August, we had some real success stories with legislatively funded and approved severity resources. I think the poster child fire was a Redwood Highway fire, where severity resources, both the retardant planes as well as helicopters, kept a disaster from happening as far as taking out the town of K Junction and the potential for a 13,000-acre fire. We've also had some real positive experiences back in 2003 with a relatively small investment. 2003 was an extremely dry year. It actually was drier than 2002. And we were very successful. We didn't have the early August dry lightning storm in eastern Oregon, but we did have an early September dry lightning storm in your neighborhood. And we basically were able to bring to bear all of the severity resources around the state, and were able to keep a dry lightning storm with over 40 starts relatively small and benign with lower costs.
I appreciate your efforts. I do remember watching those plans go in and out of Bedford and what was going on. And I also remember the biscuit fire that just about closed down the Shakespearean Festival for one summer. So I'm well aware of what you did, and I appreciate it. The question I have is, I know there's been a great effort to integrate state firefighting with the federal programs. There used to be a disconnect there, and there were some difficulties. It appears you've gotten a long way down the road of resolving those issues. Is it your sense that's been resolved to a point that we're doing a more effective job?
Chair Krieger, Senator Bates, there continue to be challenges, and I'll talk about some of that, and particularly the legal challenges for the firefighter in Idaho, the incident commander. Basically, I like to view it as an opportunity for us to help the Forest Service be successful. And I think in cases like the B&B fire, indeed, I believe our presence makes a big difference. And to the credit of our National Forest, they have been very receptive to our involvement and participation in helping them be successful.
Okay.
What is this diplomatic?
I got to remember that phrase. You know, I'm helping them be successful. I like that.
That's called diplomacy, of letting the other person have your way.
Nicely done.
Now I'd like to talk about some of the other operations in the fire program. We have the cooperative fire program, where we provide reimbursable work for cooperators at no cost to the agency. And the real value there is it extends seasonal employment time, reduces our employment costs, and it keeps experienced people that really are the nuts and bolts of our system around. Because if we had too much turnover, we wouldn't have experienced firefighters, and we'd have problems. We would not be as successful. We do provide cooperators with skilled labor. I'm really proud of the Oregon Department of Transportation Shared Employees, or what we call the Fire and Ice Program. And we actually have a handful of permanent positions and a number of seasonal positions that work in that program, where they fight fire for us during the spring, summer, and fall, and go plow snow in the winter, fire and ice.
I'm going to ask this one facetious question.
Senator Bates.
I just can't pass this up. I'm old enough to remember when you guys used to go around and empty out the bars to get our people out to fight for forest fires. I assume you don't do that anymore. Is that to break them away from the line games now? And
Chair Krieger, Senator Bates, the authority to...
The state starts losing money when they do this.
The authority to use those type firefighters still exists in standard.
Doesn't
no,
really.
We do not do that. No. We have some training thresholds.
A little bit of difference in liability today.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I think you'd probably do a much more professional job, too.
The next section I wanted to talk about is our contract services section, and I answered some questions of Representative Krupp earlier about that. But we do administer the annual interagency crew contract for ourselves, Washington Department of Natural Resources, and the five Northwest federal agencies in the firefighting business. And then in turn, the U.S. Forest Service manages the engine and tender contract. So basically we share the load. The whole concept for contract crews really started with this agency after the horrendous 1987 fire season and some of the problems we had with workman's comp costs, and we're pretty proud of that program. Got behind the eight ball a little bit as far as compliance checking, but we believe we're catching up very quickly. And again, it is part of the cooperative fire program, and it is reimbursable work. We're heavily involved in administering the National Fire Plan, which came on the scene after the disastrous Montana and Idaho fires of 2000. We provide community wildfire planning assistance. We provide advice and pass-through funds to treat hazardous fuels. Provide education to increase the defensibility of homes from wildfire. I've already mentioned the pass-through funds that we provide to rural and volunteer fire districts, two different programs that we do that for those resources, as well as public fire prevention and education programs. And then the last program I want to talk about is our smoke management program, where we administer the Oregon Smoke Management Plan, regulating forest land prescribed burning in Oregon. We do that by providing daily meteorological forecasts, burning instructions, and burning advisories across the state in order to minimize smoke intrusions into populated areas. The goal is to maintain visibility in the Class 1 visibility areas and at the same time provide adequate burning opportunities for forest landowners. We also, as a part of that program, provide meteorological expertise to the Forest Practices Program to warn the public of the potential for debris flows. We provide burning advisories and instructions to administer the open burning program that DEQ has. We do that for a fee. And we provide expertise to reduce the prescribed fire emissions in Western Oregon. So now Marvin said we'd talk a little bit about issues that affect cost and value delivery. And first on the list is federal lands. And that takes a number of viewpoints. One is certainly the accumulation of fuels on the national forest. Accumulation of fuels, we've basically got a situation where perhaps as much as over half of the Eastern Oregon National Forest is in what's called Condition Class 3 status, where Condition Class 3 means that the fire regime, that fire interval, natural fire interval, has been significantly altered. And that basically results in a buildup of fuel, and ultimately, if there are too many initial attack or too many fire starts, results in the mega fires that essentially create a lot of damage, drain the firefighting resources. That's one of my biggest fears as a firefighter. As those big fires occur, the firefighter resources get drawn to that, leaving us less to protect private forest land. Looking at the wild and urban interface, we estimate that 3.5 million acres within our Oregon Department of Forestry districts and 250,000 homes are in that interface, and that creates a serious challenge to firefighting efforts for wildland firefighters. You know, we'd prefer to be in the hinterlands, you know, protecting natural resources, and the reality is that we're put in a position where we need to be there, and it does alter our practices. Our priorities are still life, natural resources, and property, and that's where the rural fire departments and the state fire marshal come to play, is they provide that structural piece. But obviously, you can't burn out a section of line if you've got a house between you and the fire. Underfunded initial attack, particularly in some of our fire-prone districts where we have lower-value land, particularly eastern southern Oregon, landowners have struggled with the burden of the fire patrol assessment. And so that has been a challenge for us. The reduced federal capacity, there I'll concentrate on the retardant plane fleet. We've dropped from 45 planes as recently as 10 years ago to 33, and then after the entire grounding of the fleet last spring, they have brought that up to 8 planes. They're working to recertify new planes, but the reality is they may not be brought to bear on the problem this next summer, so that's a real challenge for us. The catastrophic fire seasons have basically been the result of long-term warmer and drier weather cycle that really began in 1984, as near as we can tell, and has resulted in much more severe fire seasons. On the east side, we've got a problem with...
Excuse me, Senator Bates.
I'm sorry to keep you interrupting. I just have questions as we go along. Clearly, we've had a warmer than normal 20 years of this, and I understand that. Has the federal policies as far as the amount of timber cut we're doing affected also the risk for fire as far as buildup in the forest itself? Is that a real thing, or is that just something we're reading about?
Chair Krieger and Senator Bates, that's a good question. It goes back to some of your earlier questions about federal policy. But, the fact that federal lands are not harvested in any way to the extent that they used to be means that they are seriously overstocked. And when they get to that point, the fire behavior is much more extreme, much more difficult to put out. A lot of those stands have more dead and dying timber in them, which is more volatile. And whenever that happens, the first thing you can say is, well, that's federal land. It's not our land that we have to protect. But the first thing that happens when a fire starts in those cases is all the landowners that touch federal land call us up and say, okay, what are you going to do to keep me from burning up? And that results in real cost to our program, even though we really have very little that we can do about it at this point. It does result in time, effort, and dollars that we have to spend because of that condition. It would be another reason why I wish we could get to a point of identifying what those issues are and encouraging that more gets done about them.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Regarding unprotected rangelands, the challenge there is, as some of the range fires burn unsuppressed, they have threatened and in some cases moved on to forest land, damaging forest landowners. The prime example for me was the Ashwood Donnybrook fire in Central Oregon in 1996 that was threatening the district there on a 12-mile front. And essentially it took some pretty heroic efforts by the local district, actually in partnership with BLM, to stop that. But it was a pretty tremendous problem for us. Contract resources have, at least until recently, been a challenge for us. And as we've mentioned before, we're significantly ramping up our administration of contract crews. And then business systems. Our business systems are antiquated, and as a result of the disastrous 2002 season, we did have delayed payments to firefighters and contractors, which basically hurt our ability to work with some of those folks and certainly hurt them as they waited to receive payment for their services. Concurrent then with those issues and Budget Note 3, which came from the 2003 legislative session, Marvin, our state forester, directed the agency to launch a comprehensive evaluation of all aspects of the fire program. We called it the Fire Program Review. It was led by a 27-person steering committee headed up by Roy Wu, who's since retired, and Dan Schultz, who's in the audience today. And basically, that all-encompassing review included forest landowners from all over the state, our own personnel, partner agencies, Forest Service, BLM, State Fire Marshal, and Rurals, elected officials, Legislative Fiscal Office, Governor's Office, academia, OSU's Institute of Natural Resources, Farm Bureau, Grange, and Oregon Cattlemen Association, as well as Oregon Small Woodland Association. So it was just a tremendous effort, and we conducted that review throughout 2004. The goals of the review were to evaluate the current fire program, identify areas for increased efficiency and or effectiveness, and design strategies and recommend changes. As far as the six emphasis areas, the Budget Note 3 basically directed the department to conduct a comprehensive review of the funding mechanisms for emergency fire suppression to ensure that there are adequate funds today as well as into the future. Representative Susan Morgan chaired that committee, and Charlie Stone staffed that.
That's the result of
that. And that was the precursor to House Bill 2327. I'll mention a little bit more about that in a second. Fire prevention, certainly the cheapest fire to fight is the one that doesn't start, so we need to take a look at our infrastructure and ensure we're doing the things that we need to do. Under forest fuels and hazard mitigation, we're working to develop coordinated efforts for landscape-level solutions, literally valley floor to ridgetop. With the protection coverage group, we were looking to fill the gaps where those unprotected lands fires could potentially threaten forest land, particularly on the east side. Business systems, again, that was an effort to both beef up our planning and infrastructure to manage the catastrophic fire seasons, but also to move forward on addressing and correcting our antiquated business systems. And then finally, with workforce capacity, particularly with retirements in our agency, there's a need to develop adequate numbers of qualified and experienced personnel. We have a lot of folks that are raring to go, but they don't have the experience. We need to do a better job than we've done. And at the same time, work and empower our stakeholders and partners to assist us working with our forest landowners, National Guard, corrections, parks, and others in order to build that capacity. Where we're at today with the fire program review, the work group reports are generally complete. The steering committee is looking at the final report. We have compiled and approved the recommendations, and my staff's building an implementation plan for the fire program review. And in order to hold us accountable, we have agreed and even enlisted the steering committee to hold periodic progress reports. Basically, the fire review is not destined for a bookshelf, and my direction to staff is to simply make it so. Now, we have talked a number of times about Budget Note 3 and its resulting proposed legislation, which is House Bill 2327. It does embody the key recommendations from the Budget Note 3 work group. It is revenue neutral from the 03-05 biennium forward to this biennium. It recognizes shared responsibilities of forest landowners and the general public in the firefighting system. It would maintain catastrophic wildfire insurance. It would focus increased resources on initial attack and reducing overall costs, essentially the severity resources concept. It did pass out of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources on January 26th, and it is coming to you for your review. And then finally, the impact of the 10% reduction options. First and foremost, included in the reductions would be loss of the Industrial Fire Prevention Program statewide, which is 7.7 FTEs, and that we believe will result in expensive, destructive operations fires. The second bullet there would be fewer hazardous fuel treatments in and around the wild and urban interface. Third, the risk of greater numbers of large fires due to less timely suppression action. And then finally, there is the risk of not being able to purchase fire suppression insurance.
I just want to add that these are reductions that have already been taken out of the budget by the governor. These are not the 10% reduction list that you'll be looking at later.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Susie, thank you for that clarification. That's correct. And that concludes our prepared remarks on the fire protection program.
Yes, sir. Chair Krieger, we had hoped to get that far today. We could start right into the state forest program if you would like.
Let's do that because it's a quarter until we can use that 15 minutes. There may be questions that hold us up as we move along.
Okay. Great. I'll ask Steve Thomas, chief of the state forest program division, to come up. And and Steve will walk you through our presentation on the state forest. Our start, and you can just tell us when you want to quit.
We'll quit about a minute to three.
Huh?
I got a 3 o'clock appointment.
Sounds like you got 14 minutes.
14 minutes, I go pretty fast. Representative Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Steve Thomas, Assistant State Forester, and one of the programs I oversee is the State Forest Program. And that beautiful picture you previously saw is the Sun Pass State Forest, and it's Ponderosa Pine. Snow just south of Crater Lake National Park. If you get a chance to visit, it's a wonderful place to go. What value do we create? Basically, state forests comprises 3% of Oregon's forest lands, about 780,000 acres. I'll show you the distribution and where those are located in a moment. The important part is that these forests are designed to provide multiple resources. They're multiple resource forests, per definition, the Forest Program for Oregon. Seek to integrate a variety of objectives and produce multiple benefits. Give you some idea of the benefits and the values that come off those forests. Our timber sale program basically is the economic engine that provides revenue for a number of benefits. First of all, for the beneficiaries, in fiscal year 04, we produced $63.3 million for both the counties and the Common School Fund. And we'll have a few more numbers for you in a moment. Their timber sale program also creates a range of habitats and puts stands on various pathways of development, so we get a variety and a range of plant and animal habitat as a result of that. The timber sale program also pays for facilities and activities that provide recreational opportunities. In addition, our forests are open and available for use by all Oregonians, so we do get ongoing use of the forest. And as you know, the Clackamas and Tillamook Forest, the term we use is a near-urban forest. It's basically 1 to 2 hours west of the city of Portland. In addition, raw materials and jobs for forest industries. Many of the direct jobs related to state forests are located in rural Oregon. For instance, our timber sale purchasers, each year we end up with about more than 40 different purchasers of timber. Our loggers, our contractors are all located, or most of those are located in rural communities. And lastly, the knowledge about Oregon's forest resources. We contribute to that basically because we're involved in several research cooperatives and projects. We work with a number of universities and other landowners, and the efforts that we do there brings new knowledge to everyone that's involved in the forest sector. So that's another value that we can bring from state forests. The next couple of slides give you an idea of how the timber sale program is going in terms of volume and the values produced. This slide here shows you, in terms of the Board of Forestry lands, which are in the blue hatch, you can see by biennium, that is the sold and for 03-05 the planned volume that we're putting up. And you'll see that for the biennium in 03-05, we're looking at somewhere around 500 million board feet, and we expect that to go slightly higher in 05-07. You can see that the volume harvested on common school lands, which is in the purple on the screen, has remained fairly constant. And we probably will see some increase in that if we're able to implement the new forest management plan down on the Elliott State Forest. Revenues, the next slide is revenues to counties from Board of Forestry, net revenue to the Common School Fund from Common School Fund lands. And basically, again, just to give you an idea of where we're headed, again, the blue hatch shows you the amount of revenue that is being produced off these lands. We're up around $90 million. We believe that'll be slightly higher for 03-05 than is shown here on the graph. And for 05-07, we're looking at somewhere between $90 and $110 million being produced. Again, the common school lands is fairly constant, goes up and down depending on the biennium and the amount of timber being harvested.
Yes, Senator Bates, any questions?
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to, just a little more detail if I could. And you don't have to give the answer today, maybe a later time. I'd like to see a breakdown. I assume these amounts being given to the counties and the state school fund are a result of agreements made when those lands are transferred back to the 1930s and 40s to the state.
That's correct.
And it's probably a result of those decisions made then. Could you give us an idea of what counties receive which amounts of money and what those things look like? I mean, for us, some of our counties, it's very important.
We have that information.
I'm sure you guys like to peek at that sort of a feel for it. Thank you.
The next slide just shows you again a little different view of the financial management history. This is for Board of Forestry lands. And again, you'll see the dark line to the left there by fiscal year shows the revenues received from 1995, $50 million, up to approximately $76 million in 2004. And then it shows the distribution to the counties in the light blue line. The distribution to the counties is based on a formula that's outlined in statute. And so basically, as we receive money, we run that through the statutes, and then that money is distributed to the county, and as Senator Bates asked, we can provide you with that information and give you the actual dollar amounts. You can see that that has been trending up slightly, as well as the total volume or total value. And the other one I like to point out is the red line, and that just shows the cost, the expenditures per fiscal year. As you can see, that has remained fairly constant over time, slight increases the last few fiscal years. The next slide focuses on financial management history for the Common School forest lands. And basically, again, a couple things I'd like to point out here. You'll see the diamonds. The diamonds are the costs. Basically, we have a contract with the Department of State Lands for the management of Common School lands, and they reimburse us for our costs on those particular lands. As you can see, the costs there, again, have remained relatively on an even basis. And that's a high-ticket item for them. They monitor us pretty closely on our cost of managing those lands. The other thing I'd like to point out, and I'll point out later on, too, one of the issues that impact the values of these forests is market conditions. And you'll see in 2003 where the receipts that went to the Common School Fund were actually lower than the cost. And the reason for that is was the market. The stumpage prices that we had been receiving from timber basically had dropped to pretty low amounts for several years. And then the volume that actually is harvested by the purchasers. So in some instances, you can get that combination of low stumpage prices and lower volumes being harvested and end up with, in that instance, where we ended up with less revenue.
Chair Krieger, if I could clarify one thing on this chart here, because it's not totally clear. The scale on the left-hand side of the chart is the revenue that is going to the Common School Fund.
Right, that's correct.
And the scale on the right-hand side of the chart
is
a cost. So, for example, in 2003, our costs amounted to about $3.9 million to manage those lands. The revenue that we sent to the Common School Fund was about $7 million.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I should have pointed that out.
I was trying to put that together, too.
I'm sorry, I should have pointed that out to you earlier.
You get a percentage on the 32% when you manage the county forest lands, county trust lands, or...
Yes, Chair Krieger, it works out to about what, for the Board of Forestry lands, the percent we end up keeping is...
The formula is roughly 36% for the state and 64% for the counties.
I'd like to have an explanation as to, you manage a $500, a stump, by the dollars a stump, compared to $700-something, your costs, like, I don't understand why your costs would go up and down with the value of the timber. So there's going to be times where you're making a whole lot more money off of selling $700 on the stump compared to $5. So I'd like to tell us what's happening to the differences in those figures, why one year you can manage the same amount of ground at a much lower income than you can the other time.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure I've got this straight in my mind. It looks to me like your cost for managing the forest for this run of 10 years is been right about $3.5 million. It hasn't fluctuated very much. Is that correct? Am I reading the chart correctly?
It's on the chart that you're looking at.
Yeah,
right now.
And that the revenue derived, is this cost strictly producing this revenue, or is it producing a stream of revenue we're not seeing on this graph? The reason I ask that is your return on your $3.5 million at a high point appears to be about $24 million in the year 2000, and last year 2004 for $3.5 million you produced about $14 million in revenue. And I don't know if you've subtracted one from the other, or those are two different. I mean, so
is
the profit, so to speak, $10 million in 2004?
Yes, that's correct. They received, the Common School Fund received $14 million. And they paid us a little under $4 million to manage it, so they received a net $10 million into the fund.
And Chair Krieger, if I could just get into a little bit of, I think, your question and Senator Bates' question a little bit. On a year-to-year basis, we execute pretty much the same level of planning and timber sales administration on a year-in, year-out basis, because that's what we're staffed to do. That's how many people we've got on the ground to mark out timber sales, administer them, monitor them, and do those things. When the revenue streams vary like this, there's two or three things going on then. One is market value, the timber, and it hit a low point about a year and a half or so ago. It's been easing back up again. So actually, we won't see the results of that downturn completely played out for another year or two because of the fact that our sales usually take 3 years or so to finish. The other piece is when a volume that we've done all the work for doesn't make it to the market. And that could be because of spotted owl, it could be because of marbled murrelet, it could be because of some other unforeseen circumstance that happens. Very rarely do we put a timber sale up that doesn't sell, but sometimes that happens as well. But every year we're out there basically doing the same amount of work on the ground.
What do you think the overhead cost for managing a similar size forest on private land is? And do they have different things they've got to do or less to do than you do? Do they have a 25% management cost for managing a forest?
If I could, because I did manage private lands before I came to work for this organization, it varies all over the place for private and for public. And I think one of the things that I would point to that we're probably in the ballpark is the Elliott cost-benefit analysis that was directed by the last legislature to conduct. And essentially, what that cost-benefit analysis said was that if you took the Elliott State Forest, 80-something thousand acres, put it out on the market, the present net value calculation for the land would suggest that a private timberland owner would pay between $250 million and $460 million, somewhere in those ranges, to buy the Elliott. That the probable purchase price was in that range somewhere. They said that the management plan that we are in the process of finishing up and planning to implement has a present net value of about $350 million. So it places us right in the middle of the practical range for the value of that land, which tells me we're hitting about the right stride.
Jim, I think we're about at our end here.
Chair Krieger, will plan to pick up right at this spot tomorrow?
Yep.
1 o'clock?
That'll be fine.
Thank you.
Very sure. Thank you.